Access number 11245, reel 6.
Mr. Goldsworthy, reel 6.
I had learned from the crew of the Amethyst that one of their number, Leslie Frank, who was the coxswain, was at the wheel all the way down the Yangtze, had been writing a diary. I took me 2 days to persuade Commander Cairns to agree to my having access to this diary. And on the Friday night, I finally got it, and I spent the whole of that night until about 5 o'clock in the morning reading 15,000 words, which told the story day by day of that great siege up the Yangtze, and extracting from it 1,500 words, which made a big feature in that weekend's Sunday Express. Some time later, when the wife of the ship's bosun, Sheila Smith, took the initiative of creating an HMS Amethyst Association, they were good enough to make me an honorary member. Since then, I have been fortunate in attending their annual dinners and made many friends among them. Now, Leslie Frank left the Navy, and I believe he took over a pub. And at one stage, he telephoned me, he wrote to me and asked me if I could give him some advice, because he wanted to make some money out of his diary, and he wanted to know what was the best thing to do about it. So I suggested to him that he should try Christie's or Sotheby's, some of the big London auction houses, and have it sold by auction there. That I never heard any more about until one day, some years later, one of the other members of the Amethyst Association told me that there were copies of this diary on sale in a specialist military bookshop in Ealing. I went over there, and for £18 I bought a copy of a remarkable facsimile reproduction of this big diary. It was kept in one of the naval issue books, which normally are used for logging the names of members of the crew and so on. And this had been completely full-size reproduction, and it was really quite a remarkable thing. So in the front was a frontispiece by a man called Charles Bembridge from in Canada, who said that he had been fortunate in getting the original of the diary, and he felt it was much too much of a thing to keep to himself, and he wanted to share it with other people, this historic document, and that's why he had arranged for this limited number of reproductions of the diary. I found, through the High Commissioner in London, I managed to trace Mr. Bainbridge, and I wrote to him, and we have since become very firm friends. He has been over here to attend two of the Amethyst dinners, and he is in fact in April 1990 planning to settle back in this country with his wife. Now, he told me that he eventually found this diary in Spink and Sons, the medal specialists in London, and that's how it came into his possession. it really is a very great historic interest in one of the big naval stories of all time. And it was mid-evening in Fleet Street when a Reuter teleprinter chattered out a message that a Dutch radio station had intercepted a call from a Dutch ship that she was picking up men from the water. And this was followed immediately by the additional news that they were survivors from a submarine. The message gave a latitude and longitude position, and the confusion at that stage was such that we were trying to book seats on the next plane to Holland before it became clear that the drama was in fact some 14 miles off Margate in the Thames estuary, at the centre of a veritable Piccadilly circus of marine traffic. We went down to Sheerness and were picking up little bits and pieces of this information but the whole situation was not made clear until the following day when we had a press conference with some of the survivors. The truculent had been on a refit and she'd been sent out on diving trials with 79 men on board, including 18 dockyard technicians. And she was returning to base on the surface when she was in collision in the dark with the Swedish steamer Divina, D-I-V-I-N-A. Only 15 men, including 5 who were on the conning tower, survived. Now, following day at the press conference, there came a moment which I shall always remember because it completely changed all that we had guessed about that thing. We thought that most of the crew must have gone down with the ship. But in fact, the escape had been done wearing DSEA gear, that's Davis Submarine Escape Apparatus gear to breathe, by dodging down in the flooded submarine and coming up through a concertina-like twill trunk, which allows the men one by one to come get to the open, up to the sea. The crew were telling us that they had been joking amongst themselves. They'd heard the propeller noises overhead and expected that there would be help immediately on hand. And there were even little jokes about somebody wanting to sell his a packet of cigarettes at half price because they got damp, and one was embarrassed by the fact that he was had his vest all tied up with string, and so I said to them, "Well, how many of you did get out?" And he said, "We all did. We just lined up like blokes at a bus stop, and we all got out, one after the other." And it suddenly struck me that people had not been trapped in the submarine. They had got out, and in the darkness, the help that they were counting on just wasn't there. And they'd gone away on the tide and drowned.
Did you cover the Korean War, which started in 1950?
Yes, I was the third Daily Express man to go out there. Bill Smith, Sidney Smith, was based in Hong Kong, and he'd already gone to Japan. When I got back to the office, Tom Shaw had gone out to replace him in Hong Kong and then been sent on to Japan, because in those very early dangerous days, the only way that correspondents could get their copy away from the scenes in Korea was to fly back to the base in Japan. And so we needed two men on the thing. They were flying in the cargo holds of the hard-pressed, overworked fleet of American transport aircraft with rushing petrol and ammunition into the South Korean bases. Casualties were very high. In the first 2 months, 16 newsmen died in plane crashes, on landmines, or in the fighting. Because Bill Smith could only spend every second day in Korea, Tom Shaw went to Japan to alternate with him. I came back on Sunday from a holiday and volunteered to take Shaw's place in Hong Kong, and 48 hours later I was on the way. When I got to Hong Kong, there was nothing very much happening there, and so I asked permission to join up with my old friends of the Navy, and I went in turn to Japan, and we got down to the naval base at Sasebo, and there I was joined my old chummy ship, the Cruiser Jamaica, which I had been in for the meeting, the Amethyst, and one or two earlier stories the previous year. It was I decided, as I had done in the Arctic, that the thing that would interest our readers most was to tell them the sort of conditions in which our sailors were living out there, and I did stories about the cost of living, and one of the more colourful aspects of service life there was the availability of 20 pretty little Japanese taxi dancers to partner the sailors at the Naffy Club. But the entertainments officer and the Naffy manager were unsure whether their superiors would approve of this. It was finally agreed I should mention it, and each would blame the other for having started it. To comfort wives and sweethearts at home, I added that the novelty was soon wearing off, and most of the lads considered the egg and chips at a shilling a plate better value than the shoulder-high partners at 10 old pence in advance. The British ships were, of course, part of a United Nations force, and the Labour government at home were only too eager to publicise the British contribution. So any decision to dispatch ships was proudly announced in Parliament. The ship was reported by name, leaving Portsmouth, Devonport or Chatham, passing Gibraltar, Malta, the Suez Canal, and Hong Kong. And then, by reason of a stupid censorship rule imposed by the American overall commander, it vanished into anonymity behind a bamboo curtain. The rule was that neither ships nor bases could be named in press messages, although the bases, Sasebo and Kure, were self-evident, and the naval superiority of, although the bases, Sasebo and Kure, were self-evident, and the naval superiority was such that there was no question of the enemy studying the balance of power. My cables were subject to scrutiny. The Navy didn't like the word censorship, and that was reasonable enough because I was dependent on them for information and for transmission. So, of course, to the annoyance of the crews concerned, I could not name the ships involved in various operations and adventures. But with the tacit consent of the scrutineers, it was easy to encode identity for everyone in the Navy to read. When HMS Jacob Jamaica was involved, it was only necessary to make a passing reference to the West Country crew of this colony-class cruiser. But for HMS Kenya, there was a casual mention of the Portsmouth sailors of the colony-class cruiser. This morale-defeating rule was exposed in all its absurdity by an incident involving myself and the Times. Their correspondent, Ian Morrison, was killed on a lime mine in Korea the morning after I had dined with him in Tokyo. And my cables and those of other express staff men in the war theatre were being made available to the Times until they could replace their representative. Now, it was my practice to board any ship returning from an operation and then submit the resulting story to the Admiral's intelligence officer for scrutiny, and finally take the cable to the radio duty ship of the day for transmission. One day, HMS Kenya came back from supporting a South Korean landing on offshore islands. I followed normal routine and took the cable back to Kenya for dispatch, because Kenya did happen to be the radio transmission ship of the day. It contained no reference to the ship by name, but when the Times cutting came back, it was headed, "The following dispatch was received from Mr. Frank Goldsworthy of the Daily Express on board HMS Kenya." Eyebrows shot up at this breach of the rules, and I undertook to find the explanation. It was quite simple. These anonymous ships were transmitting not merely my press traffic with their commercial call sign, but birthday telegrams and all sorts of other traffic in the air, so that the copy reaching Fleet Street was prefaced, "Received from HMS Kenya." So it was just as well that Kenya was the radio ship for the day, as it happened. They would have been furious if their adventure had been credited to Jamaica. This little incident added weight to a British protest against a ruling which had no relevance to the Korean situation, and after a few weeks it was relaxed. Sasebo was the last staging point for the American soldiers and Marines bound for Korea. Major Vincent Curl of the United States Army, who ran it, was an expert on the eve of battle psychology. When he was fighting behind the Japanese lines in Burma, he worried because he had not had time to get his personal affairs in order. So his camp motto was, "Men find better, men fight better with easy minds. We must make them easy before they go." Men made the rounds of clerks checking equipment and pay records. Then social workers asked them, "Have you any life insurance? Would you like to increase it? Have you made a will? Would you like to give your wife or parent a power of attorney to look after your property or sell your car? Is there anything we can do for your family?" Every American soldier would take out government life insurance and disablement insurance. For $6.40 a month, he could take out a $10,000 policy. The rate was the same for infantrymen going into action next day as for the army clerk on a base back in the States. By comparison, Lloyd's were charging newspapers £5 a month for every £100 cover, That is £500 a month for 10,000 pound cover for their correspondent Korea because of the high casualty rate. Of every 100 soldiers passing through the camp, the 98 took out or increased their insurance. Two signed wills and two and five signed powers of attorney. And many others sent money orders to their wives. A Red Cross girl from Dakota giving out telegram forms and free writing paper and envelopes told me, even those who never write home do so now. On average, the boys send off three letters and two telegrams each. After many days in place in planes and trains, some of them are too tired to write, and I write for them. And some, she added understandingly, just want to talk. The Post ran free film shows and Japanese variety shows and had a nine-piece Japanese band. Jan Crane, a special services girl, told me, we discourage mournful numbers even by request. Sentimental Journey is absolutely banned. Mostly the bands give them jive, hot and sizzling, till the coloured boys come up on the stage to dance. Then you feel the nervous tension just seeping away until everyone relaxes. Major Curl had a final touch. Every man slept in a bed with nice clean sheets and was told not to trouble to make it in the morning. Said the Major, by next night they'll be in the front line. They won't sleep in a bed again for weeks. They can do with a final bit of luxury. I think it's a nice aspect. That little point about the wills had an echo soon afterwards when Ralph Izzard of the Daily Mail and I went off on a bombardment mission in the cruiser Belfast. As we collected our hats and anti-flash protective gear before going into action, he bethought himself that he'd forgotten to make a will since he recently acquired a new wife. I witnessed it for him. After that excursion, I wanted to get some pictures away, and I took an opportunity to fly to Tokyo with Admiral Edwards and his staff, who were being called in for a conference. The RAF Sunderland flying boat put down at Kure to collect the captain of the aircraft carrier Triumph. When we were about to take off again, the Sunderland captain came down from the flight cabin to tell the Admiral there was a mag drop on one engine and it would be unwise to take off. But the flying boat base was only 25 miles away along the inland sea, and he proposed to cruise there on the step for us to join a second Sunderland already being prepared. As we taxied out of harbour, he appeared again, looking embarrassed, and said, are there any navigators here? We've done this trip by air often enough, but never by sea. Amid much merriment, the Admiral's operations officer went to the flight deck to lay a course through the islands. Overnight in Turkio, I dined with Sefton Delmer, the doyen of the British Daily Express foreign team, Randolph Churchill, Ian Morrison, and an Indian colonel whose name I cannot recall. It was 2 days later that Ian and the colonel were killed when their jeep went over a landmine in Korea.
I think you covered the Incheon landings, didn't you?
Yes, I was privileged to be in the cruiser Jamaica on this, which was quite the biggest single operation of the Korean War. We went up with the Kenya and American heavy cruisers Rochester and Toledo, up through the score of offshore islands into the Flying Fish Channel leading to Incheon, Korea's biggest west coast port. Like long-armed boxers, the cruisers opened up on the coastal guns on Walmido, and we watched the return fire falling short of our bombardment position. But there was no such sanctuary for the five American destroyers who raced up the channel in search of transport and industrial targets. From Jamaica, we could watch the gun duel between the American ships carrying bones in their teeth as they rushed through the Narrows under almost point-blank fire, found their targets and came racing back, still in perfect formation, as carrier-borne aircraft dived out of a clear blue sky. It was the biggest show of naval power in the whole campaign, and it was clearly intended to precede a major landing at the waist of Korea, far behind the lines of the North Korean army, still besieging Pusan in the south. It was an exciting, colourful story, and like most ships in HMS, in action, HMS Jamaica was only too anxious to cooperate in radio my copy direct to London via Admiralty Radio, because 6 p.m. off Korea is only 10 a.m. in Fleet Street, time was on my side. But there was one big snag. The American overall commander had ordered that press transmissions must first be cleared by the bombardment force's senior officer in USS Rochester. With the ships about to return to sea, there was no chance to go across to the Rochester, so I typed out the story with several carbons. A tug sent with the force in case of casualties was signalled and asked to deliver to Rochester a copy of the story, accompanied by a note asking that approval or any deletions should be signalled to Jamaica. The precious envelope, a scoop I felt because I was the only British journalist in the operation, was safely transferred to the tug as the whole group began the retreat through the islands. The tug turned towards Rochester but was just not fast enough. I stood on the signal platform of HMS Jamaica and watched in angry frustration as the tug fell further and further astern. So the story awaiting transmission never went. Another reminder that no story means a thing until it lands on the chief sub's desk at home. Next day was D-Day, and we went up through the islands again to take up our bombardment position, marked by a boy with a flag bearing the Devonian legend Yertiz, which is spelt Y-E-R-T-I-Z. Before dawn, American Marines had swarmed ashore onto Olmedo and completed the destruction of the coastal guns before the troop transports and supply ships came up the channel. All day, the cruisers battered shoreside targets in preparation for the time when the evening tide would sweep in over the shallows and let the landing craft reach the beach. I got the chance to cross to the command ship Mount McKinley, and there, seated on a high chair like an emperor, surrounded by his generals, was the 78-year-old Supremo Douglas MacArthur, watching not for the first time as his forces swept past to a landing. As the leading craft headed towards the sea wall, Rear Admiral William Struble announced, "I'm going to have a look. Anyone coming?" I was one of the half-dozen correspondents who joined him on the Admiral's barge, an unsuitable word for a fast and comfortable cabin launch. It was an unforgettable experience. To the east, the town was burning, a smoke pall drifting low over the water. The glow from the fires and the soft radiance of the sunset astern created a strange theatrical